श्री गुरु परंपरा वैष्णवस श्रीमन महाप्रभु श्री राधा कृष्ण टू ऑल ऑफ यू वी आर बिगिनिंग अगेन दिस गैदरिंग वंस अगेन गेटिंग टुगेदर लाइक ऑलमोस्ट एवरी सैटरडे वी ट्राई इन आवर तदात्म्य संघ इन दिस प्लेटफॉर्म ऑफ डिवोशनल अलायंस वेयर वी आर ट्राइंग टू कंटिन्यू टू एक्सपीरियंस दिस कॉन्सेप्ट ऑफ तदात्म्य व्हिच ऑफ कोर्स इट्स नॉट ओनली अ कॉन्सेप्ट But it's the most living reality of interconnectedness and sameness and integration of hearts, aligning of our very self so we can reach that beautiful point, conclusion, and experience that there is only one family, Vasudhaiva Kutumbakam. We are all belonging and integrated into this whole sacred circle with Bhagavan in the center, with the divine being the axis of the whole of reality, the all attractive, making everything being magnetized and dancing in synchrony around it. So, thank you so much for joining the circle to all of you, those who are joining for the first time, those who are joining for second, third, fourth time from time immemorial, each one of you, your contribution and presence is appreciated. So still we are here in Ananda Ashram a few more weeks before continuing traveling our travels to Europe in this case, and working on some books, working on the last book we are finishing, and also on the layout on the first two books translated into Spanish, and other series of lectures that we have begun, we have finished, and so on and so forth. And also I started to, there's a personal thing, would start to read a very interesting book on Thomas Merton. And I love Thomas Merton, just in case if you didn't know it. And it's always very inspiring for me to read from someone like him, because it's very sobering to be confronted with the life and teachings of someone who takes so seriously the life of prayer and contemplation and his commitment with God. It's always a contrasting experience, because you cannot avoid reading that, and that mirrors back to ask you where you are on the journey. Not in a way of guilt or neurosis, but just a healthy invitation for introspection and a further invitation to go deeper into the fire of relationship, communion, and interconnectedness. So it has been a very important reading these days for me. So let's say it will begin. I see a few hands raised. And also, there is one question that was sent by Anurad before the meeting. For some reason, I'm not seeing her today here. So I'll start with that one, since it was sent before in written way, and then we'll address the other questions that you have there. So those who are already raising their digital hands, hopefully they are not getting that tired by the time we get to your question. So I will copy and paste the question in the chat just in case for those who would like to read it, but I will read it, of course, myself. So Anurad is saying, in the last class of your recent four-part lecture series on evolution in divine love, the eternal becoming of soul, matter, and God, you referred to sadhana bhakti as a rehearsal for bhava and prema bhakti. Would you please elaborate on this? Yes, why not? Thank you. So, what did I mean by that? Sorry if I created some confusion and disturbance with that expression. Sadhana bhakti being a rehearsal of bhava and prema bhakti. So what do I mean by that? Of course, just in brief, for those who may not be familiar with this terminology, in our particular tradition, goes the Vaishnava tradition, bhakti, the journey of bhakti is divided in different ways. Rupa Goswami will divide it in nine stages. Shraddha, Sadhu, Sangha, Bhajana, Kriya, Nartani, Vritti, Nistha, Rucha, Shakti, Bhava, Prem. That's a but Vishwanatha Chakravarti will divide it in 14 stages, adding a few more in between. Or also that nine stage description can be further summarized in three stages that Rupa Goswami himself presents, which are sadhana bhakti, bhava bhakti, prema bhakti. Jiva Goswami will even talk in two stages, like sadhana bhakti and sadhya bhakti. So bhakti in practice and bhakti in the goal, so to say, or having attained the goal. Of course, there is so much to say about that, but let me contain myself and go to the point. So sadhana bhakti means bhakti in practice. The very definition of sadhana bhakti given by Rupa Goswami has to do with engaging one's senses in the service of Krishna. Nitya siddhasya bhavasya prakatyam hridi saddhyata. So by doing that, by engaging our present functions and faculties for the pleasure of God, understanding that, again, God is the root of existence and everything else is connected to that root. So when we talk about for the pleasure of God, this does not exclude anything or anyone, because we can become pretty exclusive in terms of dedicating our lives to God at the cost of everything else, which can end up in a criminal action, basically. You end up killing everyone in the name of God. And that has happened. So instead of that, we have to, in the name of God, instead of killing everyone, I acknowledge how everyone is connected with God. And therefore, instead of killing everyone, I love everyone. And that was the original plan. That's the idea. So sadhana bhakti has to do with engaging my present faculties, body, mind, words, senses, in that mode, relating to life from that place of favorable approach to God being the center, the root, and to everything else, seeing everything, everyone in connection to that. And by doing that, and sometimes we may need to, how to say, convince ourselves of doing that or remind ourselves how to do that, still we are not accomplished, so to say, completely flowing in that reality, let's put it that way. So that's sadhana bhakti. In that sense, it's kind of a rehearsal. It's a little bit mechanical, it's a little bit forced in some stages. There are stages inside the stage of sadhana bhakti. But still, we haven't attained, for those who are in that particular chapter, the full-blown feeling and ecstatic emotion, a deep, profound, clear realization through which we see everything through the lenses of love. That's Bhava Bhakti, Prema Bhakti. Bhava Bhakti is as Rupa Goswami will describe it, Prema Suryamsu Samyabhag. It's the first ray of the sun of Prem. So it's already confirming the sun is coming. George Harrison's song will be taken in connection to Bhava Bhakti. Here comes the sun. You see a ray? So the ray is anticipating, here comes the sun. And the sun is Prem, divine love, the fullness of bhakti. So sadhana bhakti is putting together all the elements in place for that yajna to begin, for that sacrifice of divine love to begin, for us to enter into that sun that is coming, for us to enter into the fire of sacrifice. So it's another way of putting it. Jiva Goswami will say in his commentary to the definition of, to the verse that defines sadhana bhakti in Bhakti-rasamrita Sindhu, Jiva Goswami says, sadhana bhakti is a preliminary aspect of bhava bhakti and prema bhakti, a preliminary stage of bhakti proper. And with this, I don't want to discourage anyone who is practicing bhakti and has not arrived at bhava bhakti or prema bhakti thinking, I'm not doing bhakti yet. No, the idea with this is don't take for granted that whatever you have is the all in all. Don't become complacent, stagnated there, thinking, I'm already devotee, I'm this, I'm that, without continuing to advance naturally toward the goal that actually is in permanent expansion, as we talked in this series. So Jiva Goswami's example is of the yajna, the classical Vedic sacrifice, where there is fire, there is wood, there are other elements that need that are required for the yajna to take place. So he will say, for the yajna to happen, you need wood. And probably you don't have wood, so you need to go to the forest, cut some branches and trunks and trees and get the wood, whatever, or pick some wood. Technically speaking, that's not part of the sacrifice. The yajna has not officially begun, but the picking of the collection of the wood is part of the sacrifice, in the sense that without it, you cannot have a yajna. So in one sense, it's a preliminary action of the official sacrifice. So in that sense, he will say sadhana bhakti is a preliminary action of the actual sacrifice of bhakti in love, when you are in that fire when the sun has come. So aha, but it's part of the whole thing. It's completely necessary. As a foundation, you need to have those things in place. Again, I like to establish that analogy. He says, you are collecting the wood for the sacrifice. So sadhana bhakti means you are collecting your faculties. You are collecting yourself, putting all together, integrating your faculties, mental, emotional, physical. You are becoming a balanced human being. So you can, when you enter into the fire, or when you attempt to jump into the fire of love, it's not, it's an actual quantum leap that is realistic. You are not escaping from your unresolved humanity. You are not running from your unredeemed, unresolved existence or childhood trauma, who knows what, because that can happen also. We can kind of rush into the heights of transcendence just as pure escapism, not like a natural, voluntarily entrance into that reality. So sadhana bhakti again can be seen in that way, collecting the wood for the sacrifice. So collecting my existence, collecting it, putting it together nicely, integrated, amalgamated, aligned. So we have a proper, strong foundation of humanity integrated with spirituality, and we can really pursue a realistic project of divine love. And we are not using the highest reality, divine love, as an excuse to not, so we don't have to deal with unresolved issues. We don't want that. We don't want to bring the reality of divine love as the perfect excuse to justify the unjustifiable. And again, that has been done throughout history. The greater the ideal, the more it lends itself to justify the worst possible things in reality. So many people have done that, to the point again of killing millions in the name of God. But it can begin with us justifying our unintegrated self, our evasiveness, in the name of the highest ideal. And if you don't know how to put a limit to that, you can end up creating a whole Holocaust in the name of God. I don't want to scare you, but just talking about how impotential we can go in that direction. Absolutely. So that's why it's important to understand sadhana bhakti in a very balanced, realistic, and harmonized way. So again, putting all the things together, collecting the wood, collecting our faculties, preliminary to enter into the, to starting the fire, to starting the yajna, to having our heart on fire with love of God. That's basically the yajna has started. So, But now we are putting all things together so that flame of love can really shine in a realistic way, again, sustainable way. Something else that comes to mind, going back to the question that I say, okay, sadhana bhakti is a rehearsal of bhava bhakti. Again, rehearsal, like when you are a musician, for example, you rehearse, you make mistakes, you are not yet fully accomplished, consummated, and eventually you are ready to enter into the stage, to enter the scenario and make your accomplished presentation. So that's another way to conceive sadhana bhakti. Still is more, I'm practicing, I'm trying, it's not fully natural, fully integrated, fully blown, full-fledged, however you like to name it. But still, it's part of that. No? I'm trying to relate to reality as it should, and I'm still failing miserably, probably. But I've received in theory the information and the revelation by Guru Shastra Sadhu how reality should be looked upon. So I'm trying to relate to reality following those guidelines, although I don't have the vision that they have. You follow, for example, as I mentioned in my book, Radical Personalism, we are saying, I don't know, we are, to give you one example, we are to look at this world, the material world, as being pervaded by God in every single atom. We are to understand that God's presence, Krishna's presence, is everywhere in matter. That's the vision of the highest devotee, the Uttam Bhagavat. Yumam pasyati sarvatra sarvam cha mai pasyati. They are seeing Krishna is in everything and everything is in Krishna. They have that vision. Now, so we will say that's how reality should be looked upon. That's the sober lenses to see reality, to witness what's actually going on beyond our filters and assumptions and biases that make us see reality, who knows in which way, so many ways that are not actual facts, objective reality. So we say we should learn to see reality as these highest devotees see reality, see the world fully pervaded by Krishna. And someone might say, okay, but I don't see it that way yet. And I'm not there, so I cannot imitate, right? I cannot just force myself to have that vision immediately. So what to do? Because at the same time, I'm receiving this information that the highest seers of truth are seeing reality in a certain way. And I cannot deny that it makes sense. It's inspiring. But I'm not there. So how to deal with that without imitating that in a cheap way? So that's why I refer to Sadhana Bhakti being a rehearsal of Bhava Bhakti. You receive that, how the greatest seers approach reality. I'm not there, but I try to incorporate that information. Okay, reality is to be looked upon in this particular way. I'm not there, but I will behave as if that's the case, because I know that's the case. I know the material world is pervaded by God. I know in theory, I may have had some glimpses of that. I'm not fully there yet, but I know on some level. So I'll try to conduct myself in life according to those guidelines, so to say. So in that way, you are rehearsing how the greatest seers are naturally looking upon this world, although we are not having that vision. But we are trying to align our life and living our life as if that's true, knowing that is that's the case, but still I don't have that vision. That will be mainly the idea of sadhana bhakti as a rehearsal of bhava bhakti and prema bhakti. Sometimes also I've described sadhana bhakti as a theoretical appreciation of bhava bhakti and prema bhakti. In other words, we hear about the reality of divine love. Again, we are not there, but you can, what to do with that, with those descriptions? Just say, I'm not there, so I will never read that. Imitate them cheaply, neither of those. So I can hear that and I can appreciate that, even if it's in theory. Wow, that's so moving, that's so inspiring. I'd like to be there. I like to enter into that world. I like to gradually step into that reality. That's how you gradually participate in Leela. No? As I remember, we mentioned in the very last class of our series of lectures on radical personalism, that was last year, that how to participate in Leela or in divine play. You cannot just press a button and be there. So you have to start to participate in some way. So when you hear the Leela, you have to learn to relate to the Leela, to feel yourself part of it, to start to participate. So how I feel myself part of the Leela? Well, maybe you can hear, as I gave the example in that class, I recall, the Govardhan Leela, Govardhan Leela and Vrindavan. So you can draw some lessons from that Leela that are very applicable to your present stage. And in that way, you can feel, oh, I can relate to this. I feel part of this because of the lessons I'm drawing from it. For example, as we know, Indra is sending all these rains to Braj. Krishna is lifting Govardhan. Before lifting Govardhan, the Brajavasis are approaching Krishna with full surrender, full trust, without knowing, asking for shelter, but without knowing how the shelter will look like. They're not coming to Krishna. Give us a shelter and let the shelter take this particular shape, or give us your mercy in this particular packaging. They are not putting those conditions. They are going for shelter and they're open to whatever has to happen in terms of the shelter they are requiring. And Krishna, of course, does the unthinkable. She just picks a big hill, like if it were a mushroom, very easily and for 1 week. And that's the shelter. No, it took a very unique form. They were not expecting. So the lesson here is, when you're asking for shelter, do not expect, do not project how the shelter should look like. Be open to whatever form that needs to take for it to actually be shelter. So that's a lesson, one of many. We can draw from one of many Leelas, such as Govardhan Leela. So you can hear the Leela, you can draw that lesson, and you can feel that applies to me. And in that way, I am part of that Leela. I feel myself part of it. So you start to participate in some way in your present state in the Leela. So that's another way of speaking about rehearsing, no? From our stage in Saddamakti, rehearsing in comparison to the ultimate reality of Bhava Bhakti, and Prema Bhakti. So some thoughts. I could continue talking on that, but there are other questions. And one last thing that I mentioned briefly is that, if I'm not mistaken, the quote that I share in the class from which Arnu Rad is asking the question, I was talking about how to look at the world and quoting, if I'm not mistaken, quoting one verse from the Bhagavatam that says, one should look at the world in the same way as God is looking upon the world. So Krishna is looking at the world in a certain way, and we should learn to be empathic, tadatmya, to align ourselves with how he looks at the world of matter and relate to it accordingly. So again, it's very much about empathy and proper connection of vision. Raga Anuga Bhakti means following into the footsteps of the Brajavasis, so also implies to connect with their mood and to somehow align with that according to where we are. Again, every time we're speaking about seeing the world as if someone else is seeing it, following the footsteps of someone else, we are not talking about cheap imitation, evasiveness, copy paste, but empathy, connection, and at the same time, a very realistic acknowledgement of where we are in our stage and how we can align with that. So everything is realistic, as I say, going back and concluding that full circle with the collecting of the wood, as sadhana bhakti, as a preliminary, putting in place, collecting all my faculties, collecting myself, so I can enter into the fire of divine love of a life, passionate affection for God in a very sustainable way. So anyhow, some thoughts. We could continue with that, but there are more, some other questions. So let me go. Yeah, there. Who else is raising their hands? We have three hands raised. So let's begin with Jugal Kishore. If you can unmute yourself.
Hi, Maharaj.
Nice to see you.
You as well. Maybe I'll admit that partially I raised my hand simply so that if a question does come up, I'll have the opportunity to ask it. But you mentioned in this answer that you just gave, I mean, part of my question is this, you know, how important is belief in God for spiritual advancement at a very, very general level? You know, can one advance spiritually without even having a theistic sort of positive affirmative belief in God? What would that look like? What would that mean? And then maybe to go to give it a little more flesh based on what you just said, you know, we come to some theoretical acceptance that yes, what Guru Shastra and Sadhu Sangha is telling us sounds good. this sounds nice. I like this. I would like to have this. And therefore we act as if these things are true. That kind of, what's the term I want? Suspension of disbelief, right? Like, if I want to enter into a fairy tale, if I want to really enjoy a fairy tale, I have to act as if it's real. I have to pretend like I'm really going there. You know, Robin Hood and Peter Pan, they're real. And so I can really feel the things that they're feeling. So I guess to connect it to my question, how important is it that these things are objectively true versus we just accept subjectively that these are good? Therefore, I will act upon that goodness, regardless of whether I can objectively prove any of it.
Well, thank you.
Sorry, that's a big question.
That's a great question. It deserves a long conversation. Maybe eventually I have to invite you to my podcast and we have to have the whole conversation only on that question. So I'll say something, and of course, whatever I may say is always insufficient and partial and small in comparison to the ocean of the topic. But it's a very important question. And I like, of course, to begin qualifying what you mentioned. You spoke about belief. How important is belief in God for spiritual advancement, even if I understood correctly, just replicating your question, even if we may lack some particular personal experience that the things we are believing in, we don't know if they are true or not, but I choose to believe in that, it creates a healthy container, so to say, healthy orientation to life that I feel it gives me an experience, hopefully so. So I like always to end up in this like converging point of experience. Mm-hmm. Experience. Ultimately, experience is the pramana. I like to first make that point that I make in radical personalism. In Sanskrit, it's called pratyaksha. Ultimately, pratyaksha means personal experience. So sometimes in our tradition, we'll say the ultimate authority is shabda, or the revealed knowledge of the scripture. Yes, but what's shabda to begin with? Well, Jiva Goswami explains in the Sandarbhas. I'm sorry if I will go to a few different branches. In the Chinese calendar and the Chinese, what do you say? Calendar or whatever? I'm a monkey, so I used to go all around different branches. So that's part of my DNA, so I'm justified just in case. So Jiva Goswami in Tattva Sandarbha, he says that shabda or revelation, revealed scripture, actually is a form of pratyaksha or personal experience. He calls it vaidusha pratyaksha, which means, for example, for us, Srimad Bhagavatam is shabda, right? Revealed text. But what's Srimad Bhagavatam? That's the personal experience that Srila Vyasadeva had in samadhi, in trance. So it's a form of pratyaksha, it's a form of personal experience. So it always boils down to experience. And for us to accept that such a thing is true, that the Bhagavatam is Vyasa Samadhi, is revelation, is a scripture, has anything valuable to tell us, for us to accept that, we ideally, hopefully, we must have had some personal experience of whatsoever, of some sort. If I absolutely lack all personal experience and nonetheless I accept the Bhagavatam as revelation, I'm being completely cultish. I'm very, very, I'm completely ready to be part of the worst possible cult because I'm accepting anything blindly without even any personal experience. So that's not the idea, of course. That's why Krishna the Gita says, verse 2 of chapter 9, Pratyaksha Avagamandarmyam. He's describing bhakti, says this bhakti is to be understood by personal experience. So I'm saying all this in the context of your question, talking about belief. And I like to make a difference between belief and faith. You know, for me, they are not the same thing. Although, unfortunately, we collapse these two more often than not. Like many times as I talked in radical personalism, we collapsed fitting in with belonging. And that's very problematic. You actually need to belong and you are trying to fit in. But you confuse the two, and you, instead of looking to actually belong, you just try to fit in by stopping being who you are. No, fitting is, I stop being who I am so I can fit in. Belonging is, I acknowledge who I am so I can belong for who I am. That's absolutely different. But we collapse these two ideas many times, that that's criminal to ourselves. So similarly, we may do something similar between faith and belief. And we may confuse, like people actually ask, you know, and I always like to quote Carl Jung in this connection. Once he was asked, do you believe in God? And he replied, no. And then he continued saying, I know he exists. So he made a clear difference between believing in someone and knowing, having personal experience of that someone. It's like if someone asks me, do you believe in Jugal Kishore's existence? And I was like, no, no, I don't have to say if I believe or not. I know him. He exists. I have experience of that. So faith, generally faith is described or defined as trust in, based on experience. No, that's a very like zip file way of describing faith. No, the trust that comes from experience. And I will even qualify that experience is undeniable. No, undeniable experience. No, like an experience that even if you start to think, well, probably was my bias and my filter and I was hallucinating. Actually, what I experienced was not true. I was just projecting my own stuff. But sometimes you have, I hope, each of us, that for us to be here today talking about this, hopefully we have some type of experience that was utterly undeniable. It was completely beyond our faculties, beyond our expectation, beyond our control, beyond our common perception, but at the same time, absolutely real. Not only absolutely real, but more real than everything else we used to perceive on a daily basis and how we used to perceive things. So on the basis of those experiences, we are expected to, I mean, we will have faith because again, faith is the natural reaction to that. And on the basis of those experiences, we may, and here comes another layer of that, on the basis of that experience, we may have faith of things we have not yet experienced. But that's based on an experience. Like to give you an example, no? For example, I don't know. I've heard almost with every single disciple of Srila Prabhupada that I've talked and met in my life, which are a good number of them. And I always like to ask them, so tell me what it was to meet with Srila Prabhupada. And mostly I would say probably 100% of everyone told me about how powerful that was. Just the first meeting, the first glance, like that threw them into a trip, a whole journey that was absolutely unprecedented. So that created for them naturally some faith in this person, right? I mean, just with the first glance, he gave me an epiphany that I never had in my whole existence. So I have faith in this man, so to say. One will think that, and then naturally he will say things after such experiences. He may have said things to his disciples that they are not having an epiphany of those things, a personal experience in that moment, but they have had an epiphany in relationship to Prabhupada that makes them have faith in other things that Prabhupada is saying, though they are not having the same type of experience that Prabhupada may be having. Do you follow my point? So it's an extended faith, if you will. No, I'm having faith in what you are saying, Prabhupada, not because I've had first experience of this, but I've had first experience of you, which makes me to trust fully what's come from you. To give you an example, right? So that's in itself an experience. That's how I like to put it. For example, if you get to, again, you may get closer to someone like Srila Prabhupada, and you will have an experience. You may not be having the experience he is having, but you are having an experience of getting close to someone having such experience. You follow? Someone has pure love for Krishna, and I get close to that person. With this, I'm not merely saying physical proximity is the all in all, but if I'm honest and sincere, and I see that the feet of such a person, listen, open my heart, I will have an experience. I may not have the exact same experience that person is having, but I'm having an experience of being close to their experience. And for us, that's in itself an experience. That's more than enough. So for all of that, for me, is faith. It has nothing to do with belief. For me, belief is more kind of a, like it's sort of mental conviction. No? Like, okay, I believe that's true. I like to believe. And that comes, of course, to your second question, that some people may even embrace some beliefs of those sorts without having a personal experience. Or some people may call what I've just described, like you are believing in some things. While I will describe that as a form of an extended faith, as I told you, right? Sometimes they say, okay, you believe in what Prabhupada said, though you have not experienced that. Yeah, but I have experienced him, and that makes me to believe in him. Well, actually, I will say to have faith in that because it's based on experience. So that's how I choose to describe these terms. And but there are some interesting conversations even from people like Richard Dawkins and others who are like hardcore atheists. And he himself will say, like, to embrace like Christianity as some form of cultural vessel that somehow gives some well-being and like wholesomeness in your human experience. Okay, I accept that, he will say. And he will say, like, I may even recommend that. Of course, he immediately will say, but God does not exist. I don't believe in that. So, but he will, even atheists will agree that to just adopt a set of beliefs or convictions in relation to whom you don't have experience, they may create some sattva, if you want to put it that way. They may help to organize your life in a more healthy way. And of course, for me, the whole thing is, for those who are doing that, still they're having an experience of that. Do you follow me? Even if, okay, I will organize my life around all these beliefs that I don't have experience with, but by living my life according to that as a belief, that gives me an experience, that makes me continue to embrace those beliefs. And probably gradually, I stop believing in that because I'm already having an experience and that becomes faith. You follow my point? So yeah, that's how I'm thinking about that in the present moment. Even if in the beginning you start believing something because it feels good, it sounds good, but you lack experience, but you need to believe in something. Everyone has some form of faith. Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita says, Shradayam Purusho. A person is his or her faith. You are your faith. Whatever you have faith in, that's what you become. So people have different faith in different things. And again, faith is based on experience. So for me, every time someone tells me, I don't believe in God, I totally understand. Because for me, that means I haven't had an experience of that. So it's okay. I totally understand. I myself consider myself an atheist for years. I was like anarchist and punk and atheist in my teenage years. But in time, I realized, yeah, that's because I was just having faith in what I had experienced so far. But eventually, when some experiences came, they were undeniable. So for those who say, I don't believe in God, basically, they are saying, I haven't had an experience of God. Or whatever experiences I've had in the name of God were absolutely godless, unbecoming. Distorted, giving a very like toxic notion of divinity. So that people only needs to just have an experience of healthy connection with transcendence. It's not necessarily that we need to deny absolutely the existence of spirituality or things like that. And that's not a need. So anyhow, some thoughts. I don't know if that makes any sense, Yugal Kishore. That's a great question. Thank you. There is so much more to explore, but something to begin with. Thank you.
Thank you, Maharaj. Yeah.
So we'll continue with the next offering presentation by Rasangi.
Dandavat pranams, Maharaj, and to everyone.
Dandavat.
I'm back from the retreat where I was practicing being the best radical personalist I can be.
Wow.
Yes,
Did
and
it work?
it was wonderful, Maharaj.
Did
And
the
I
other
find
people did the other people in the retreat survived you being as radically personal as you can? That can be quite intense for
definitely.
some people, not because of you, but just because of what it means to be radically personal.
And it takes a lot of courage, but it's so intimate and personal that everyone liked it. They love it.
Okay.
Everyone's needing and craving personal attention, connection, someone to see them, who they are, and accept them like that. So I
Yeah.
love it.
Thank you.
And what I have to ask about today is a little controversial. It might be, but it's from your first book, and
No
it's
problem.
okay.
Accustomed to
Okay.
that.
And it's because I love what you've given us so far about the unique individual relationship that we each have with Krishna, one Krishna to one devotee. And that what you said was to claim an eternal fixed relationship is kind of taking away the free will of
I
the
mean, you are
soul.
referring to something I mentioned in my first book.
No, but and this you mentioned last week, but what I want to talk about now is verse third canto, chapter 9, text 11. And
Again,
it's a
which verse from which
it's
book?
Bhagavatam,
Yes.
canto 3,
Yeah.
chapter 9, verse 11.
Okay, yeah, famous verse, yeah.
Oh, my Lord, your devotees can see you through the ears by the process of
Yeah.
bona fide hearing. And then you manifest yourself in the particular eternal form of transcendence in which they always think of you.
Yeah.
And then in the purport, and then it does talk about, I love this so much, it confirms what you said, that the Lord becomes subordinate to the desire of the devotee, so much so that he manifests his particular form as the devotee demands. That's like,
Demands. That's a good one.
oh my God. And then, but then in the next paragraph, the attachment of the devotee to a particular form of the Lord is due to a natural inclination. Each and every living entity is originally attached to a particular type of transcendental service because he's eternally the servitor of the Lord. Lord Chaitanya says that the living entity is eternally a servitor of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna. Therefore, every living entity has a particular type of service relationship with the Lord eternally.
So, dilemma.
So it's a little bit of a conundrum.
Yeah, that's why I wrote the whole book about
And you
it.
know, our dear friend Bhakti Sukh Maharaj is also writing something,
Oh, really? I didn't know
harmonizing.
that. Hopefully, he doesn't get in trouble for that.
You know, he wants to get everyone out of trouble, he said too. But
He wants to get me out of trouble?
he said a little that there was some arguments
Anyhow,
against.
I am aware of all that. No problem.
So how does you're talking about the free will and how it's, if we consider a permanent sthayibhava, I guess it is like a fixed sthayibhava, that somehow eclipses free will.
Yeah, there are
So
many considerations to say to mention, and of course, here comes my own take and my own opinion. And I know that there are many devotees in the Gaudiya community who have a different take, and I'm fine with that. We can hopefully coexist with differences of opinions as they exist, even in Vaikuntha, in Golok Vrindavan, there are disagreements and different outlooks to reality. So I'm okay. But I have my own convictions based on what Shastra say, what I've learned, and many other things. And that's why, again, that's what I've shared in my first book, in Inherent or Inherited, which in itself created its own spiral dynamics, let's put it that way. But that's fine, totally fine. And it's part of the conversation we are trying to have on this and other topics, and hopefully we can develop more and more capacity and maturity to engage in conversation, especially in conversations when we have differences of opinion, because I've seen that many times that's not, unfortunately, that possible. And many times, very quickly, we switch to attack, defamation, or trying to put down the other person, and denial of whatever evidence may be presented on one person, whatever the topic, again. So, and I'm not saying I'm perfect in that, but I hope to be part of those types of conversations in a more and more substantial way, because again, that's happening in eternity. See, if we want to go to the eternal plane, you have to coexist with the fact of people in Vaikuntha thinking Krishna is an avatar of Vishnu, because they think like that in Vaikuntha, and they are in Vaikuntha. So you cannot try to say they are wrong, they're in Maya. Actually, Vishnu is an avatar of Krishna, and we have the scriptural proof. So they will have to fall from Vaikuntha because of that apasiddhanta, who knows? No, they are in Vaikuntha, and they will remain there because nobody falls from Vaikuntha, just in case. But regarding your question, and you are quoting, of course, some things that I mentioned, and you are referring to this particular purport with Srila Prabhupada, says something different or seems to say something different. To be honest, I don't know. That's my reply. I don't know. I don't know. What do I mean by I don't know? I don't know from which place Prabhupada say that, because I have all other quotations where Prabhupada indicates something that lends itself to the opposite direction, that bhakti is not inherent. So I don't know, in the sense, I don't dare to say, okay, Prabhupada actually meant that, because I'm totally sure what he meant. I'm inside his heart and I can tell you, I don't dare to say that. I can just say, according to my study of Shastra and research and share with other Vaishnavas, this is the conclusion I've reached, which makes sense for me, and which I think is very clear evidence, although some people may disagree with that, and it's fine. And how and why other acharyas may have said something different. At times, I can try to think about it, as I've tried to do in the second part of my first book, and to offer alternatives. Maybe they say this because of this, maybe they say that because, but at the end of the day, I don't know. And I think we should be okay with that. I mean, we should be okay with, on one side, trying to think together about different aspects of our tradition, trying to address situations where there may be disagreements. If one feels the call for reconciling or thinking deeply about that, there's place for that. And also there's place for, how to say, remaining open for uncertainty in some aspects. No, like if you ask me, like, why Prabhupada say to some people that we fell from Vaikuntha? Another famous case. And why in some other places he say nobody falls from Vaikuntha? I can conjecture, and there's place for that as an exercise of trying to understand my previous acharyas in service to them. Not because I'm thinking I'm smarter than them and I'm better than them. No, but because I'm in service to them, I'm trying to think as much as I can to understand them and to serve them better. But at one point, I may say all that I have to say, but at the end of the day, it's like, but I don't know. I cannot for sure say, he say this because of that. He say we fell from Vaikuntha as a preaching strategy because he saw that his disciple has some Christian background with these samskaras of falling from Garden of Eden and paradise. So he used some framing that will help them, and eventually he was planning to give them the actual real version. I don't know. I can conjecture in that direction, and it makes sense to me in many ways. For other people, that will be relativizing Prabhupada, and that's an offense. I don't take it that way. So again, there are differences. So that's what I can say, Rasangi. That's what I can say. But yeah, of course, in my book, I try to address the verse you quoted, 3.9.11. That's quoted in my book, in the first one. also I tried to address the verse that Prabhupada is referring to in his purport here, which is Jivera Sarubhai Krishna Nitya Das Krishna Tatasta Shakti Veda Veda Prakash, which says the Jiva is Krishna Nitya Das, the eternal servant of Krishna. And I explained that verse in detail in my book and try to show how it's not saying that bhakti is inherent, but just showing that every soul is dependent on God, because every soul is dependent of God. And my point is, but there are so many other statements that make it clear that there's not in a specific relationship already established. So what Rupa Goswami says is when you find statements in Shastra, you cannot just cherry pick the one you like the most. You have to reconcile and put all of them on the table. Not just, okay, this one supports my point. And someone say, well, but what about these other 108 verses which seem to say something? Oh no, I don't like to watch in that direction. I just keep this one. But that's not what the scriptures say on how to approach scripture. Vedanta Sutra say tat tu samambayat. One has to take Shastra in a integrative way, reconciling apparent contradictions as much as one can. And maybe at the end of that exercise, we may still have a difference of opinions. And we should, then comes another lesson, which is how we agree to disagree and how we can love each other despite disagreements. That's a big one, no? But it's possible, no? It's possible. It's funny because sometimes we... Sometimes we see Vaishnavas having very nice conversations with, I don't know, Christians, let's say. And we disagree on many things with them. No? Reincarnation and many other things. I'm not saying that's bad. I'm just saying that's with most, that's a fact. But they can talk nicely. But when it comes with another Vaishnava that I have a difference of opinion, sometimes we are not that able to talk that nicely with them. Wow. So we have to do some family therapy, so to say.
Maharaj, yeah. What I loved was what you, and I've been thinking about it a lot. You know, actually, the free will, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. How yeah. far that goes. And I was talking to someone, my husband, well, there's still free will. You are who you are eternally, but then from there, there's free will. But I think what you were saying.
Yeah. I was saying, thank you for that. I was going to mention that.
Okay.
And I think I mentioned that to Bhakti Res some weeks ago. We were talking on that. And for some devotees, they will say, no, to have an inherent bhakti or relationship with Krishna doesn't cancel your free will. You already have a fixed relationship. And in the context of that fixed relationship, you express your free will. And some others, like me, will say, I prefer to think of free will as more free will in the terms of not only I can choose how to serve Krishna in an already predetermined relationship, but I can choose first whether I want to relate to Krishna or not. Second, how I want to relate to him, how I want to love him specifically. And third, when I choose, okay, I want to serve Krishna, let's say, Madhurya Bhav, how I want to specifically express that. For me, it makes, it may, again, it's my opinion. I own my opinion. But for me, it gives a more cohesive sense of free will and of the nature of love, which again is voluntary, right? So love is voluntary. So the more the love, for me, the more voluntary will be. So I like to think Krishna loves us so much that is, he's giving us that scope of choice and freedom to choose whether to love him or not, to choose how to love him or in which way or another. And when we choose that, how to serve him inside that particular choice. That's my take. Again, I know that others will still explain this same theme in another way, and I'm fine. I don't feel the need to convince or convert or whatever. I know it's not that it will reach the day where everyone will agree on this topic. I don't think that's going to happen. And it's okay. I think we should be okay with coexisting with differences of opinion and again, learning to love each other despite those. I think that's the actual lesson. And in one sense, to be honest, that was kind of the main purpose of my book, as I tried to make it clear in an introduction, like inviting for dialogue in the Gaudiya community on topics we may have difference of opinion, and from that, and addressing the dialogue in such a way that it increases the trust and the affection and the cohesiveness in the community. I'm not saying that happened exactly in every way I expected. I was a little naive probably, but it happened in many ways. No, I had very beautiful exchanges and conversations and how to say, and results from people who read the book that share how much they were inspired and their first faith nourished. But anyhow.
And I also read the part of the book, half of it, and I was so inspired. I learned so much, and I'm not sure yet what my final decision is, but it opened me up to think more deeply about it, and that's been so valuable.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's also an idea. Even if you absolutely disagree, at least you open yourself to expose yourself to different ideas, and in itself, that's a healthy exercise to keep your mind open. I mean, I like to do that myself. I like to read books that I know I won't agree with them on some things, not on everything, because why to read a book you will disagree 100%? That may be too much. All that may be an interesting exercise unto itself. So I think that's a healthy exercise to keep ourselves exposed on some level or another to things that are different than our official narrative. Because if not, we can become so easily fanatical and blinded and just buy into one way of thinking, feeling, willing, and that can be dangerous.
And bonsai'd.
Yeah, even less than a bonsai, but yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Rasengi. Okay, next question, Gayatri Devi, invited to unmute yourself. Welcome to the gathering.
Pranam, so good to see you, Maharaj. A warm welcome to everyone who's here as well, too. Thank you so much. I have a simple, perhaps basic question, but you're so kind to take those as I see along the way as well, too. And perhaps consider it in the perspective, of course, of the other questions that have been laid out on the table today. So as we think about our practice, our sadhana, our experience, pratyaksha, and even free will, as Rasangi and you were discussing here, I'm curious about your perspective. When I ask the question, who am I? I often think about that from two perspectives, the self or the Atman and the personality. And sometimes my heart gets confused about maybe dual versus non-dual perspectives on both of those components of who I am and how I relate to the world and to Krishna as well too. So I'd love just to hear you share a few words on your perspective about those two pieces, please. And okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for the question. Important one. Again, I'm so sorry. I mean, for me, it's always, I'm so sorry that for me, this type of gatherings is a very moment of joy and blessedness, but also it's a moment of deep anxiety. Why? Because you present such nice questions that I'm in such an anxiety because I see that five more of you are having questions and I'm like, wow, these questions are so great. Just I have to expend 3 years to answer one question and it won't be enough. So I have such an anxiety trying to be concise. I'm not good for conciseness, just I'm making it clear, as you may have witnessed. So that's part of the mixed feeling, but I think it's beautiful in its own way. So thank you for the question. So who am I? Yeah, of course, there are so many ways to answer to that question also. That's another conversation. Because recently also I was again giving a series of lectures in Spanish about self-love in bhakti. We gave that series like a month ago in English. And we were mentioning that. Not that many times when we are asked, who am I? Generally, we tend to reply by identifying with what we do. I am what I am. I am a human doing, not so much a human being. Depending on what I do, I am. No? We are trying to assert our identity on the basis of our performance, so to say, in the world. How well you perform is who you are. And we become human doings instead of human beings, no? Or human havings. I am according to what I have or what I think I possess, and so on. And we were talking how a very accurate way to define who I am is not on the basis of who, of what I do, what I have, of what other things of me, or not even of what I think of me, because that's generally not very accurate or generous many times. So who am I in the eyes of Krishna? That's the most accurate picture. How he's seeing me, that's who I am in the most realistic way. And he's seeing me through the eyes of unconditional love. So that's a nice way of replying who I am. I am the beloved of Krishna. Now, that's a, for me a good... Of course, we can say I'm an Atman, a spiritual being, and that's also true. But also I like this way of replying. No, I am the beloved of Krishna. That's way more real than so many of the false... of the upadis, of the false designations that we impose on ourselves when replying to this question. So in your question, you are asking, okay, we have the Atman, the soul, and we have, let's say, our psychological self or our personality, which is a result of different samskaras or impressions acquired life after life from time without beginning, let's say. So in this particular lifetime, I had a physical body, I have a psychic body with a certain disposition, but which is fluid, so to say, according to different lifetimes. In next life, I'm being born, I don't know, in an African tribe, probably my psychology will be different and so on and so forth. So in one sense, we may say, I'm not that. So one could say that. So there is no place for me to relate to that when thinking about who am I. So I'm just Atman, pure Atman. That's my only identification. And I get the point, but also it can get quite dysfunctional if you make that type of black and white cut and somehow you try to like, what's the word in English? Sorry. Like unrelate yourself from your psychic self, from your personality, from your mind, from your emotions as a human being. And just in the name of, I'm an Atman. And I'm a soul and I have nothing to do with all this stuff. Well, you can say that, but do you have the realization to say that? Yeah, dissociate. Thank you, Victor. So we may become very dysfunctional, going back to this important point, in the name of pursuing transcendence. We can be evasive, escapist, and creating some form of disembodied spirituality. And I'm saying this especially in the context of bhakti. Why? Because in bhakti, if we will be in an Advaita Vedanta, Gyan Marg, another tradition, okay, there is a place for being more heavy on this. But bhakti is very unique because bhakti is user-friendly, susukam kartum, is to be practiced from a very integrative place. So in bhakti, let's say in this lifetime, you have a particular personality, which you can, let's call it heavily, like it's a karmic byproduct. Now, let's use that term for a moment. No? Your personality is a karmic consequence of previous actions. It's not with you forever, so it's not eternal. You could say that. But also you could say the nature of bhakti and the power of bhakti is such that the more we open ourselves in bhakti, going back to the definition of sadhana bhakti, which is engaging all our faculties and functions in the service of Krishna, bhakti, and this is mentioned in Shastra, I'm not creating this here, and I'm making it up, bhakti is defined as a shakti, is an energy. So this internal energy, bhakti, is spiritualizing all our functions, our body, our senses. That's why we hear about the spiritualization of the body, spiritualization of the senses. That's why the body of a saintly person is considered spiritual, no longer material. What happened in between? No, bhakti entered and was poured on every pore of your being. So that's not only has to do with physical body, but with psychic body as well. There is one section in Radical Personalism that I referred to this in the chapter on individuation. So there, Rupa Goswami is describing Bhava Bhakti, going back there, Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. He's saying that when Bhava Bhakti descends, it's and the sense upon the mind and all the functions of the mind, and is surcharging and spiritualizing all that. So we could say our personality, which is something acquired karmically, becomes spiritualized by bhakti. And in that way, that personality will accompany you in eternity, fully spiritualized. We have talked about this in the past, I think Rasangi asked some time ago or someone else. So my point with this is, if that's the case, there is no necessity of dissociate myself from my present personality as something worthy of being rejected or something that will be over at some point. Because if I understand my present personality fully integrated and dedicated to bhakti, becomes fully spiritualized and accompanies me in eternity. So I can, when I say who I am, I can integrate these two, Atman and personality, because that's what I'm trying to do in my bhakti practice, actually. No, I am an Atman, I have an acquired personality, and the proper integration of these two, the proper spiritualization of these two, is what eventually we call the spiritual body and a spiritual identity, which is an identity. You still are an Atman in the spiritual world, but you will have a body and a mind and a psychology and a personality. Everyone in the spiritual world has a personality. Again, we are not impersonal. So how that happens? No? Well, it starts to happen here, basically. So that's for me the user-friendliness of bhakti, right? It's very, very relatable to where we are now. So those are some thoughts. I don't know if they make any sense in terms of how to think about this who I am in a more integrative way, instead of making like a cut and a dichotomy, Atman, everything else, and instead...
Yeah, absolutely beautiful. Thank you so much. Right on point and very concise as well too. Thank you so much. Yeah,
I'm trying to make my best in terms of conciseness. Yeah.
The monkey that's works one. As that's well one. Too. Yeah. Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you for the question. Very important. Thank you. Okay. No, I was seeing some comments, but yeah. Okay. So we have one last hand raised over there in Ireland, not UK. Sweta Radhika and Amanda Vikram. Thank you so much to both of you for being here. So please, yes.
Pranam, Smaraj. So in last week's Ishtagoshti, you briefly mentioned how that Harinam initiation is not really Diksha. Although largely, like these days, it's called Diksha, you know, like, but what I was thinking is, if that's not Diksha, then what's our relationship with the spiritual master who gives Harinam? And sometimes devotees get like Harinam from one and then Diksha from another, mm-hmm. but then cannot have two Diksha gurus.
No.
Yeah, so then like what do we call the spiritual master who gives the Harinam? Is he not Diksha guru then?
Harinam guru. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's in one sense it's a formality, I will say. In one sense, and I always like to quote Srila Siddha Maharaj in this connection, which is very simple but very substantial, because we can get a little bit like entangled, like, okay, my Harinam guru, my Diksha guru, who is my guru, which is my relationship if I have one, or Diksha guru and Harinam guru. But at the end of the day, it's all about relationship, no? Like who is the person that is nourishing you the most. That's it. Now, that's how Srila Siddha Maharaj replied when someone was asking him, who is more important, the Diksha Guru or the Siksha Guru? Mm-hmm. To begin with, why you need to make one more important than the other, no? Like sometimes we create this type of hierarchies in our mind. No? And he replied with common sense. Uncommon sense. No? You say the most important guru is the one who helps you the most. whether it's the Siksha Guru or the Diksha Guru. And that may shift in time. and it's okay. No? Of course, there cannot be more than one Diksha Guru, because Diksha is the giving of certain mantras, and the mantras are always the same in our tradition. So you won't receive different mantras. Only one time you receive mantra. Mm-hmm. Harinam Guru is always also one. You receive Harinam. Harinam is Harinam. Siksha Gurus can be endless, although, of course, with this I'm not saying in a cheap way, because sometimes we can also, in the name of having many Siksha Gurus, we end up taking no one as a guru, actually. Because again, ultimately, as Srila Samaras will say, we are to enter into the land of gurus, where everything is guru. The land is guru. The sand is guru. The tree is guru. Everyone is guru. But that's not a cheap attainment. So we cannot just say, yeah, for me, everything is guru. I mean, you have to have the vision for that. And for that, generally, you need first one person to teach you that, or a few people. No? And gradually, you can expand the capacity to perceive guru tattva coming to you in so many different places and ways. And there's place for that at some point. Again, guru tattva is very elusive and very hard to understand, because it's very flexible and very dynamic, and can be very easily misunderstood. No, sometimes, and maybe it's not so much related to your question, but it's related to guru tattva. When people ask this question, "Who is your guru?" No, you can imagine. In my particular situation, that's an interesting conversation that is opening. Someone asked me, "Who is your guru?" But that took me in itself to think about it, and also to realize that the question in itself is wrong, because the question is framed in singular, and that's not correct. Why the question is limiting the scope of me replying, giving only one name? It's like if I ask you, who is your friend? Hopefully you don't have only one. You follow? You will say, why are you asking in singular? Who is your friend? I mean, I have many. So in the same way, why who is your guru is singular? Well, that's against our understanding of guru tattva, according to our tradition, of a plurality of gurus, of a land of gurus. The Bhagavatam talks about 24 gurus, Diksha Guru, Siksha Guru, Harinam Guru, Barma Pradarshaka Guru, Purva Acharya, no? Previous Acharyas, gurus. Peers that are your gurus. And so many ways you can talk. So I personally, and not like a forced, like, how to say, forcing the situation to justify my own case, but just naturally concluding, yeah, we need to learn to speak about guru in a more broad way, deep way, because that's what guru tattva is. If not, we can become so reductionistic and sectarian many times, and end up with a very like narrow-minded notion of guru. Okay. And it's funny, because many times say, no, Maharaj, when I was asking who's your guru, I was referring who's your Diksha Guru. But it's so funny, because we, most of us at least, belong to the line that comes from Bhaktivinoda Thakur and Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur, who emphasize so much Siksha Parampara. So it's so funny that we emphasize so much that, but when we come to talk about that, we are limiting the discussion in the direction of Diksha. So that's something that we ourselves need to accommodate in our own selves, no? So, but yeah, basically that's the idea, no? Diksha refers to the giving of certain mantras and to initiation, and Harinam. Again, there are different traditions, even in the Gaudiya tradition. In many places, Harinam is not given, just Diksha is there. So just for us to also, although many of us may come from a certain line where things are done in a certain way and it's okay, to keep our minds open enough to acknowledge that that's not the only way. So many times Harinam was Harinam. Harinam is independent of Diksha, but Harinam is given, sometimes it's received from a sadhu, like the sadhu is giving us, he, she giving blessings for us to chant. But Harinam is independent. No, it doesn't mean that, okay, before you receive Harinam, initiation, if you want to call it like that, from your guru. So what was happening with your chanting of Harinam? Did it have no effect at all? It was a hoax, because you were chanting Harinam before, right? So we have to put all the things together inside of us and be coherent. So yeah, I was chanting Harinam before, and the name of Krishna had an effect on me, incredible effect on me, that takes me now to receive that same name from the lips of a particular person that inspires my heart. So that name will come with certain mood of service and chanting, bhakti samskars, and as the relationship with that particular person, which already have started there and before that, becomes more and more consummated or established, diksha comes as a, what in Christianity will they call it, what? Confirmation? No. So they have baptism. To make some parallel, again, I'm not trying to make a full parallel, but you have baptism and then confirmation. No? So confirmation, the word says in itself, no? It's confirmation of something that happened before the confirmation. So in some way, diksha can be seen as that in our particular tradition. There's already some harinam, and diksha is a confirmation of the commitment, whether with that particular person that gave this harinam, or as you mentioned, it may be another person, but that's still a confirmation of my commitment to the path. For example, I know disciples that receive harinam from Srila Prabhupada but didn't receive diksha from Srila Prabhupada. And I know that in some cases, I've heard from some of them that there is some kind of, I don't want to call hierarchical, but some kind of difference is made. Okay, if you received harinam and diksha, you are more of a Prabhupada disciple than if you only receive harinam. Or if you receive harinam, diksha, and sannyas from Prabhupada, then you are way even more. And if you stay in ISKCON after all that, you are even more different people. I'm not joking about anyone, but how some people think. You follow my point? And I wouldn't say that at all. That's not necessarily the case. I mean, of course, you can be totally connected with Prabhupada, having received all those initiations, but someone may be connected with Prabhupada without having ever met him personally, may not even be a disciple of Prabhupada, but there can be a very genuine connection. And you may have received some initiations of Prabhupada, and you can end up being an abuser. And that has happened. So do follow my point. So where is the connection with the person? No? So going back, some devotees may have received harinam from Prabhupada, not diksha. They received diksha from someone else, hopefully from someone they also feel some connection with, although they may feel my main connection if with Prabhupada. I have some elders who are very close to me in my life who are Prabhupada disciples, and they, some of them received harinam from Prabhupada, not diksha. And they received diksha from someone who eventually had some problems, let's say, and the relationship is not one of guru disciple at present with that person. But it doesn't mean that there's something lacking from Prabhupada toward them. So again, the main guru is the one who is helping you the most. I will try to end up on that particular note. And the journey is very unique. You know, the journey of every person is very unique in terms of how do they relate to Krishna, the guru principle, to parampara. And at least speaking on the base of my experience, I wouldn't dare to be too conclusive about there's only one way to do it. This is the only legal way. If it's not happening like this, you are disconnected. You have no shelter, no mercy, no inspiration. This is the formula. It doesn't happen like that. So it can happen in so many ways. So we should be careful of appreciating everyone's faith and connection for what that is. And for that, of course, we need to take the time to get to know the person and to explore their hearts and stand in awe appreciating that particular connection whenever that's there. So some thoughts. I hope that helps, makes any sense. What to do? I
don't yes, know. I have more thoughts now. I was wondering why is it then, I mean, not why, it's interesting to me that we are asked to recite mantras of guru that gives us harinam, and I'm you know, how important is this? And
what do you mean by reciting mantras from the guru that gives us Harinam?
Mantras, like a particular guru.
Like pranam mantra, you mean?
Yeah, sorry.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, like we could have a Shiksha guru that's more important, but we don't recite their mantras, but like we recite mantras of like guru who gave us Harinam or Diksha. So just interesting and wondering, like, you know, how important are these?
I will say that's important as long and that's as long as that's important for you. Well, I mean, the idea is that all the things shouldn't be reduced to a formality. All the things shouldn't be reduced to a mechanical, formulaic repetition. Like, okay, I have to do this, I have to do that. It has to come from a very genuine place of my heart. Okay. This mantra encapsulates a description. Ideally, a pranam mantra for a guru is kind of a zip file and encapsulate the description of the personality of that person. And by reciting the mantra, we are kind of evoking all those qualities that we love and we offer ourselves to that person in doing that. That's the purpose. And we beg for the mercy and we go deep into that connection. If that's not going on, I'm not saying stop doing that. I'm just saying one should rethink from which place I'm doing that. And also one note is that not necessarily every guru has a pranam mantra. Well, that's something that I will say. I have not done like any research on that, but I know many lineages where there's no pranam mantra for any guru. So that's also, I know that in the line of Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta, that has been the case. Somehow we have all these pranam mantras for Jagannath Das Babaji, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, which if I'm not mistaken, actually all of them were composed by Ananta Vasudev, interestingly. That's another conversation. but my point is, in other lineages, and I know many of them, they don't have specific pranam mantras. They offer pranam to their gurus with more generic mantras like Om Agyanati Mirandasya Agyanam or Nam Shrestham Manumapi, so the ones that sometimes I recite in my own Mangala Charan, that are not pointing to any specific person, but to the principle of guru in itself. So everyone can recite them and connect with their own chosen guru, so to say, in their heart. Now, that's also why. It's another way of saying that's also part of the sensitivity, like why in a kirtan, generally you won't sing the name of your guru. You may say, sing Jai Gurudev, Jai Guru Maharaj, but those are words that lend themselves to be interpreted for each person to with their own guru. You follow my point? It's not that I'm singing kirtan and I start to glorify my guru with his, her specific name. So all of you who may not even know who that person is, are forced to sing that and do not know who you are relating to. So we can use a term that is more accommodating, like Gurudev, and everyone can feel they can sing that and connect with the particular person they feel this is the most prominent guru figure in my life. So that's why in Kirtan you will sing Gurudev, Guru Maharaj, Prabhupada. Prabhupada is a title, it's not limited to Bhaktivedanta Swami. Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta is also called Prabhupada in all the Gaudiya Math branches, except for ISKCON, Prabhupada is Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur. I remember this one story. When I went to India first time, 2007, I had the fortune to associate with Madhu Mangal Prabhu. He was like the personal kirtani of Srila Siddhar Maharaj. He was blind by birth. So he, at that time, he was 80-something. So he was a very incredible soul, beautiful, sweet kirtaniya. Actually, I had the chance of recording an album with him. I mean, I didn't do anything. I just had a hand recorder and I thought, we have to do an album. There was nothing recorded from him. So I was just with him in his room for many days. And he will sing all the songs, of course, by heart. And I will accompany him sometimes with mridanga, with kartals, and very sweet memories. So anyhow, once he was singing this Prabhupada Stotram, Pranamami Sada Prabhupada Padam, this famous song that Srila Siddhar Maharaj wrote for Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur. So he was singing it. And at the end, he concluded singing Jaya Prabhupada, Jaya Prabhupada, and so on. And the kirtan ended. And one devotee asked him, Madhumangal Prabhu, when you say Prabhupada, you are referring to Bhaktivedanta Swami Maharaj or Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. And Madhumangal Prabhu became very disturbed by the question. Like very unsavory, like very out of place, basically. And he replied, clearly, not angry, but just disturbed, like, I don't know, he said, Prabhupada is Prabhupada. No? That was his point. No, like implying, whomever is Prabhupada for you, that's Prabhupada. Whomever is Prabhupada for you, that's Prabhupada. No, don't enter into those details. Like each one will have their own ways. There's not just one single way, right? So anyhow, going back to this idea of the pranam mantra, no? And sometimes the guru being addressed by a more generic mantra, which is not less of a thing. No, because I'm saying this because sometimes if not, we think, I don't know. I've seen devotees like starting to have disciples like, okay, now I have to get my pranam mantra. And it's like, no, not necessarily. That doesn't work like that. No, it's like, okay, I'm having disciples now, so who will compose my pranam mantra for me? It doesn't have to happen that way. If it comes organically and that, okay, but it's not like, okay, you're a guru, now you have to have a pranam mantra, like all these type of requisites. It makes it too formal. So yeah, I'm not saying one thing is better or worse, but just given saying that there's precedence for addressing the guru without a pranam mantra. But of course, if there is a pranam mantra, that's beautiful in itself, but we should connect with that in a way that is beautiful, equally beautiful, not from a place of feeling and not like mechanical repetition, obligation. And if I find that my Siksha guru is my most prominent guru and he or she doesn't happen to have a pranam mantra, again, it's not that that's limiting your approach to that person. No? It's not that, okay, I cannot pray to that person, I cannot develop my relationship with that person without the pranam mantra. That's the main point. No? At the end of the day, those things are details. Those are things that are even formalities that, if they are facilitating your inner connection, that's great. We celebrate that. But you have to be careful that those do not get in the way of the relationship, which is the actual thing we want to develop. So, okay, we'll stop there. Thank you so much to all. And one thing before you leave, because I'm remembering now, is that since in a few weeks I'm traveling to Europe, I will be in another timeline. I'll try to keep with the meetings, but I will start from the next Saturday. Our meetings will start 1 hour earlier, if that's okay for you, hopefully. Because originally I make it this time thinking for those in India, it will be late, but they can come. Those in New Zealand will too early. But at the end of the day, the boats in New Zealand is too early, complicated for them. So I'm thinking more about those in India, it's too late for them. So if I do it 1 hour earlier, it will be more sustainable for most of you, the rest in US, or Europe. It's a sustainable timing. I hope for Rasang is not too early. I don't think so, because you are 3 hours early, but it will be like what, 7 of your time there. So yeah, instead of starting 11 a.m. EDT time, starting from next Saturday, we'll be starting 10 a.m. EDT time, just in case. Whenever I share the flyer, I will clarify that just in case also. So thank you so much to all of you again for your friendship and sharing and openness and contribution. It's a very big blessing for me. Sriman Mahaprabhu ki jai, Sri Harinam Prabhu ki jai, Sri Sri Gaur Nityananda Gaur Gadadhar Ju ki jai, Sri Radha Madan Mohan, Radha Govinda Dev, Radha Gopin.